The scripture reading tonight is from 1 Corinthians 1, verses 18 through 31. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the proven. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through wisdom did not know God, it pleased God through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For Jews request a sign, and Greeks seek after wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block and to the Greeks foolishness. But to those who are called both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things that are mighty. And the base things of the world and the things which are despised, God has chosen. And the things which are not, to bring to nothing the things that are. That no flesh should glory in his presence. But of him you are in Christ Jesus, who became for us wisdom from God and righteousness and sanctification and redemption, that, as it is written, he who glorifies, let him glory in the Lord.
So as Rick read a minute ago from 1 Corinthians, it says, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men. And from that, it begs the question, what is the wisdom of God and what can we learn from that? And thinking about that, I don't claim to understand the wisdom of God in any means, or even the men that we're going to look at who had the gift of wisdom from God. But I also know that you don't have to understand necessarily how the internal combustion engine works necessarily to drive a car, how microwaves work to use one. So we're going to look at these men, kind of see why it was they were considered wise men, kind of credentials. And then after that, we're going to see what was important to them and what we can learn from them. So that's basically what I said. We're going to look at these people see what we can learn from them. And there's basically three different examples, or groups, I guess I'll call it. The first one's really a group. After that, we go on to specific men. But the first one is Daniel and his other group, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as they later become known. Now, if you would, first, to get a little background on them, let's turn to Daniel, first chapter, starting in verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought him to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. And the king ordered Alphenaz, the chief of the officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. And the king gave them a daily ration of all of his goods and such. And basically what he did was they went out and they conquered lands. And he figured, well, is there anything good in this land that I'm conquering in? And maybe I can learn something from them. So he ordered that the choice people in his eyes would be taken from these lands, brought back, educated in his learning. And then see, you know, if there's something I can learn from them, maybe I can take their counsel. Maybe at some point they'll be good in dealing with the people that we've captured later on down the line. And we see from later on in the text, we have, there's four of them. In this case, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I'm sure all of you have at least heard these names. They were chosen, of course, because we read they had potential. So you can imagine being of a conquered nation, taken by a king who just conquered you, put into his service. You know, what kind of things might you think? You might think first, well, you know, you don't rock the boat. Things are going pretty good now. You know, things were bad, but now I have potential. I'm going to go. I'm going to, you know, make something now of myself and do what I need to do to grow up in this king's eyes and serve him so that I can have a better life for myself. But in this case, none of them actually did that. They had as their first priority, we're going to serve God. And okay, God put me in this position. I'm going to do the best I can, but I won't compromise on what's important to me. And that's what this is all about, what's important to them. You see, in Daniel 1, 8 through 16, the first thing that they did is they decided, no, we're not going to take these king's rations, what he gave us to eat, what he gave us to drink. We're going to do what God has said for us to do. So we're going to do according to that. And I have a little small there tested. The overseer of these youths was, you know, he wasn't sure about this because his life was on the line also. You know, sometimes we forget we have such different times now with life has such a high value, everyone's life. But back then, I mean, if you crossed the king, if you even looked like you crossed the king or you had something to do with someone else who crossed the king, you very well may lose your life. So it was his job to make sure that these youths were well taken care of. And they continued in this. You remember they were chosen because they had no physical defect along with a lot of other things. But these four decided that they would not defile themselves with this. And you know, the guard said, well, I don't know about this. So he said, well, test us. So test us. He knew the end of it before it began. He knew that he would come out. He knew that God would make a way for him. He had that faith from the very beginning that things would work out in his favor. And all he had to do was just continue on in that path. So, of course, he tested him, and it worked out. It worked out right. They, at the end of, I believe it was a week, they looked physically more fit, more plump. I believe that the text reads just off of God's food that He had authorized them to eat. And then it says after this in 17, as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. So that's kind of along what I was saying before. You know, we're presenting these men who had great wisdom, but not only did they have great wisdom, they had God's wisdom. This wisdom was from God. It was not from men. And this is one of the things that goes, and, you know, it's just another, I don't know, check mark. It says, yes, these youth's wisdom was from God, and God gave it to them. Later on, it says in Daniel 1, 18 through 21, all of these four Jews among all the rest of them from all the other nations, they all four were found to be 10 times better in every aspect than all the rest of them. So, you know, you kind of read that and glance over it, but you can imagine, I don't know how many they had, but I'm sure it was 10s, 20s, whatever, and there were four that stood out, and every one of those four, the ones that stood out by a large margin, were from this nation, were following God. And so those were the ones that stood out. It's not... there was a specific pattern to this. This is obvious. This is not a chance thing. Because first it was only these four, it was all of these four, and by the degree that they stood out shows that God was working, blessed them with wisdom. Now, you can think to yourself, you know, you look at this at the very beginning, and Daniel and the others, they made the decision not to eat this food. And we know from previous reading that God blesses you when you follow him, and when you don't, he curses you. So from this, you can see, you know, found to be 10 times better. If they'd have gone with the first idea, well, let's not rock the boat. Let's just go along with it, and we'll serve the king, and you know, things will be good. They would not have turned out like this. They definitely wouldn't have turned out this well. So this one I really like. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and it really bothered him. So he called all of his advisors together, and he said, tell me my dream, and then tell me what it means. And the interesting thing is he said, tell me my dream. So not only did they have to come up with the interpretation, but they had to tell him what it was. And this scared all of his advisors, you know, to death. I would imagine it would. I couldn't tell anyone, honestly, what their dream meant, and I definitely couldn't tell him what it was. until they first told me. And that's what his advisors wanted. They said, well, tell us your dream and we'll tell you what it means. And this king, he was actually, he had some wisdom himself. He said, no, you're just stalling. You want me to tell you your dream, then you're going to make up whatever it is you think it might be and tell me whatever, and it's going to be totally make-believe. No, I want to know that what you tell me is correct. So to know that it's correct, I'll believe you if you can first tell me what the dream was. So none of them could, and they all kind of stalled and, you know, hem-hawed and whatever and backed off. And he said, no, you're just stalling. All of you, I want dead. He's going to kill them all, every last one of them. All of his wise men, he's going to have them killed. Now, if you remember, Daniel and these other three youths were of these wise men, so that was for them too. They were to be killed also. When one of the king's men comes to Daniel and tells him what's going on, he says, give me some time. Give me the audience with the king. I will tell him what the dream is, and I'll tell him what it means. And at this point, this is the first he'd heard of it. It is the impression I get. He didn't know what the dream was at that time. He definitely didn't know what it meant. But he said, give me the king's audience, and I will tell him. Before God revealed to him what this dream was, he said, give me audience with the king. So he had faith enough to say in his mind, all I have to do is set up the appointment, and God will make this right. He will tell me what this dream is. And of course he did. God gave him the same dream. Daniel knew what the dream was, and he knew what its interpretation was. So he goes to the king. He tells the king, this was your dream. This is what it meant. And the king bowed down in homage to him. And he said, surely your God is a God who imparts wisdom. So this, again, is another showing, I guess, that this wisdom that they had was from God. Especially in Daniel's case, because Daniel could not have known a dream or interpreted a dream without that from God. The next case isn't really Daniel, but I kind of grouped him with his friends because it's the same time period, same people, same thinking, and they had contact with each other. In Daniel 3, the king set up a golden image of his God, and he said, whenever any music plays, you will fall down and you will worship this image. And, of course, Daniel, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego said, no, we will not. But what I want you to see, and this is what I've always loved about this one, you know, music played and they didn't fall down, they did not worship. Then a little, and people saw this, they reported to the king, and the king said, well, you know, is this a mistake? You know, he's given them an out. He says, this is a mistake. You really meant to bow down and worship, didn't you? And I love the response. This is, again, at a time when the kings could have said, you know, anything. Kill them, torture them to death, torture them, but let them live, keep them alive. He could have said anything. This is what they said. They said, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. They did not mince words. They just said, we don't even have to answer you. Our God is willing. If he is willing, he is totally capable from delivering us from your hands. They didn't say, oh, well, you know, our God kind of, he doesn't want us to do that kind of thing. They just flat out said, we don't even have to answer you in this matter. We will not do it. So, of course, the king flies into a rage, and he says, you know, build up that fire extra, extra hot, and throws them in, and God does deliver them. They're walking around. Not even the smell of smoke is on them. So these men, you can see, were blessed from God's wisdom. And again, we'll show this as we go through, the interesting thing about them, you can see from the first decision they make not to eat the king's rations, to, you know, having faith, Daniel's faith, to know that I'm going to know what this dream is, and not only am I going to know what this dream is, I'm going to be able to give him the interpretation. To this boldness, you know, talking to the king, this someone who holds your life in their hand, I don't even need to answer you. Our God will save us if he's willing. The thing that they put first was their God, very, very evidently, especially in this last statement, which I really enjoy. And then we'll go on to Solomon. Solomon, there's, you know, of course, he's recorded as the wisest man in history, and his wisdom was a direct gift from God. As he asked God, you know, may I have this wisdom to judge your people? Now, when Solomon became king, he was very young. A lot of sources say 20. Some of the Jewish historical records have him at 12. Either way, he was young, especially for a king. He was a boy. It's recorded, a lot of this next stuff is in Jewish history and not necessarily in the Bible. But it was recorded in Jewish history that the people at this time were saying, woe to you, O land, whose king is but a boy. And later on, I believe this is recorded by Solomon. John actually read this verse today. What do you, O land, whose king is a boy? And it goes on, you know, Boys, they don't know, they're foolish, they don't know when to go out, they don't know when to come in, they don't know how to judge rightly. It's more blessed to have a king who's a man who knows when to drink, who doesn't drink for drunkenness, but drinks because he's thirsty, and so on. At this time, if you remember right, Solomon was king, but just before him, one of his brothers, his older brothers, which is typically the standard, the older brother becomes king. One of them actually didn't become king, but he tried everything he possibly could have too. He rode around, he said I was king, everyone was celebrating him, he had some people following him. In his mind and in a lot of people's mind, he was king. Until David, who was on his deathbed, said, no, it's Solomon. And at that point, they were a little scared. But even if you remember, this brother of his, a little later on, tried to arrange a marriage that would have potentially set up a coup, a mutiny, to overthrow King Solomon, to allow himself to become king. So this is what Solomon's dealing with. He's a boy. He's judging a great nation, God's nation. And he has brothers who are vying for the throne, at least one very, very actively trying to become king. And all of these people, they're not sure, you know, we have this boy king, he's not going to be able to do this. And at this time, we have these two women who come up to him for judgment. And let's go ahead and read that in 1 Kings chapter 3. And the two women who were harlots came to the king and stood before him. The one woman said, O my lord, this woman and I live in the same house, and I gave birth to a child while she was in the house. It happened on the third day after I gave birth that this woman also gave birth to a child, and we were together. There is no stranger with us in the house, only the two of us in this house. The woman's son died in the night because she lay on it. So she arose in the middle of the night and took my son from beside me while your maidservant slept, and laid him in her bosom, and laid her dead son in my bosom. When I rose in the morning to nurse my son, behold, he was dead. But when I looked at him carefully in the morning, behold, he was not my son whom I had born. Then the other woman said, No, for the living one is my son, and the dead one is your son. But the first woman said, No, for the dead one is your son, and the living one is my son. Thus they spoke before the king. The king said, The one says, This is my son who is living, and your son is the dead one. And the other says, No, for your son is the dead one, and my son is the living one. The king said, Get me a sword. So they brought a sword before the king. The king said, Divide the living child in two, and give half to the one and half to the other. Then the woman whose child was living, one spoke to the king, for she was deeply stirred over her son, and said, O my lord, give her the living child, and by no means kill him. But the other said, He shall be neither mine nor yours, divide him. Then the king said, Give the first woman the living child, and by no means kill him. She is his mother. And when all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had handed down, they feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. So we see two women come forward, and they both had sons. One of them died. Now, at this point, you remember what kind of position Solomon is in. People really don't believe in him. They don't see that he has wisdom. But after this, all of Israel heard of the judgment which the king had handed down. They feared the king, and they saw the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. So it's important at this point, I think, for Solomon to show that he has wisdom, that he can do this job, that he is not just, you know, a young boy. You're underestimating me, basically. So it's not really sufficient, I don't think, in this case to say, you know, she's the mom. So maybe this goes a little deeper, and I had to dig a little bit. This is according to Jewish history. The husbands that died were father and son. Again, this is not in the Bible. This is according to Jewish history, but it makes a lot of sense. If the men that died were father and son, then that makes the women mother-in-law and daughter-in-law. Now, if they're mother-in-law and daughter-in-law, this makes a lot of, this is a big deal. This isn't just about having a son. This is about, for the older one, this is about having a son. For the younger one, if it was the older one's son that lived, then this is now her dead husband's brother. And according to the Jewish law, you'll remember that if you are a Jewish woman and you have no babies and your husband dies, his brother is to then become your husband and bear children for that first brother. So now she's at a position where she may well have to marry this baby. Now there's also I don't know if you call it an out, where if the man refuses to marry the woman, he can say, no, I do not want to marry him, and then she can go before the elders of the city. She takes off his shoe, spits in his face, and says, such is done to the man who refuses to marry Right? So, unfortunately, that can't be done until, according to the law, this young man is 13 years old. So this young lady is kind of in a bit of a predicament. She has no husband, she now has no son, she's now betrothed to a baby, and either she marries him 13 years from now, or 13 years from now, she goes through this, if you call it a ceremony, and does not get married. So she's in a bit of a pickle. So to her, it is better if it's her son, because then if it's her son, everything's good, she has her son, she has her heir, she goes on living, she can find another husband. If it's not, or if it is her son. It doesn't matter either way if it is or is not her son. According to Solomon's judgment, he said, bring me this sword and divide the baby in half. If that happens, it doesn't matter whose son it is, she's freed also. So all the better. Now she doesn't have to marry, or she doesn't have to marry, she doesn't have to wait 13 years, and she doesn't have to raise her brother-in-law, I guess. So that works out great for her also. Now, Solomon, he needs to show that he can do this job, that he's wise enough. Saying this is the woman's mother doesn't necessarily cut it. He needs to show them that this is the child's mother definitively. This is the child's mother. So he needs them to basically, he needs an admission. Now there's another old law where if two people come to court and they're both holding an edge of a tunic, the tunic is to be cut in half and half given to each one. So you can see all of these people, they're looking around, including the two women down there with the argument over the sons. This king is just a boy. He's foolish. He doesn't understand this law. He doesn't know that that really doesn't apply to this baby. They're thinking this. So they're thinking, you know, actually, maybe he does really think he's going to cut this baby in half. And he's the king. He can cut the baby in half. So they're thinking this is actually going to happen. The one, the mother, says no because it's my baby. The other one says, yeah, go ahead and cut it because then I'm free. Now immediately there, their true nature, their true colors came out, and everyone saw exactly who was the true mother, who was not the true mother. It was obvious then to everyone that King Solomon had wisdom. Not only did he have wisdom, could he do the job, but this wisdom was God-given. This story, there's a lot to it. It goes very, very deep. And to think, you know, looking back on it, okay, yeah, I understand that law. I understand about the marrying the husband's dead brother. But to put it all together, to put it all together on the spot, and then to come up with a solution that quickly that made these women immediately, you know, just come out of their lives, show their true colors, come out with an admission, that took some wisdom. I could not be able to do that. Looking back, I can understand, but hindsight is 20/20. Next, Solomon, this man who has great, great wisdom. As John said this morning, you know, he wrote a couple books. In Ecclesiastes, John, I love how he put it. He said he's looking for what is useful, what is good in this life to do. He is looking for the meaning of life, is the way I put it. Not just what is good, he is looking for why we are here, what there is to do. What is this about? Why? You know, it's the same thing people, you know, when I was younger, everyone was looking for the meaning of life, and they all wanted to run up on a mountain and meditate for years and years and years, and it would come to them in a vision or something like that. It seems so, I don't know, not necessarily ironic, but it's exactly what God said. He made the wisdom of men to be fools, exactly that. If they had just known, they could find it in a book. It's written out for them, nice and clean and simple. They'd save a lot of time, that's for sure. But at the end of Ecclesiastes, in verse 13, this is the end of a matter. All hath been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole of man. And I skipped the word duty there because it's inserted. You can put it there either way. I think it's a little clearer without it. This is the whole of man, or this is the whole duty of man. Either way, that is what we're here for. If you go to Ecclesiastes 12, let's turn there real quick. And we'll read 9 through 14. In addition to being a wise man, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, and he pondered, searched out, and arranged many proverbs. Preachers sought to find delightful words and to write words of truth correctly. The words of wise men are like goads, and masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. They are given by one shepherd. But beyond this, my son, be warned, the writing of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is wearing to the body. The conclusion when all has been heard is, fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. I read the second one. Let's read the first one. Okay. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, when you will say, I have no delight in him. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and clouds return after the rain, in the day that the watchmen of the house tremble and mighty men stoop, the grinding ones stand idle because there are few, and those who look through windows grow dim, and the doors on the street are shut as the sound of the grinding mill is low, and one will arise at the sound of the bird, and all daughters of the song will sing softly. Furthermore, men are afraid of a high place and terrors on the road, and the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags himself along, and the caper berry is ineffective. For man goes to his eternal home while mourners go about in the street. Remember him before the silver cord is broken and the golden bowl is crushed. The pitcher by the well is shattered and the wheel at the cistern is crushed. Then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanities. So that's the introduction. He's going through and he's talking about the almond tree blossoming the grinders bending low. This is, of course, it's a man's life story. He's getting older, and his time is going on. And then at the end of this, in verse 9, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanities. The dust will return to earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. This is the introduction before, this was verse 1 through 9, and again in Ecclesiastes 12. This was the introduction before the last few verses in Ecclesiastes 12. So he's saying, man goes through life, he starts, he gets older, and then he dies, and he goes back from dust to dust. All is vanity. What was that worth? It was nothing. He's there, he's gone, life goes on. Basically, that's what he's saying, is life goes on. What did you do? What's lasting? There's not much. You can look at it honestly. You have your children that live on past you. You have some effect. In your time now, you have some effect on the people that live now. But without this last bit here in Ecclesiastes 12:13, then it really is dust to dust, and there really is nothing to it. With all of that, everything was vanity, and there's nothing beyond that. It's just dust to dust, and it's an end. And that's where it stops. So, you know, there are some people now who say, you know, when you die, there is no heaven, there is no hell. But everything ends, and that's that. Well, we know there is a heaven. We know there is a hell. But for those of you who want something that you do now to mean something, without this last bit, where it says, fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole of man. If you do none of that, then everything is all vanities of vanities. Nothing is lasting. Nothing goes on. Nothing holds. That is the only thing that, you know, think about it. You're in heaven, you're in hell. I don't know, 200 billion, million, trillion years from now, you're sitting there looking back, thinking about where you were and what you did. Do you care about what your job you had or what clothes you wore or what you had to eat? I mean, those things are, you know, they fulfill our mind and everything now, but then what matters? Did you fear God and keep his commandments? I guarantee you that will matter to you. Because that will decide where you are at the end. And looking at Solomon, you know, the wisest man who ever lived, he ends this book, this Ecclesiastes, which is, you know, just a string of you know, wise sayings. This is, I don't know, essence of Solomon. And how does he end it? He says, fear God and keep his commandments. He was an interesting man. He didn't do that throughout his life. He learned the hard way in a lot of ways. He did what was wrong, and then he came back and finally figured it out in the end. And what did he figure out in the end? Well, he should have been fearing God and keeping his commandments all along. The next one, couldn't do anything without leaving him out. I think sometimes we leave him out of just our grouping of wise men just because he was so exceptional on so many fronts that he almost just seems like he's in his own different category. But this one's always impressed me, this Matthew 21, 23 through 27. Let's go ahead and read that. When he entered the temple and the chief priests and the elders of the people came to him while he was teaching and said, "By what authority are you doing these things, and who gave you this authority?" Jesus said to them, "I will also ask you one thing, which if you tell me, I will also tell you by what authority I do these things. The baptism of John was from what source? From heaven or from men?" And they began reasoning among themselves, saying, "If we say from heaven, he will say to us, 'Then why did you not believe him?' But if we say from men, we fear the people, for they all regard John as a prophet." And answering Jesus, they said, "We do not know." He also said to them, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things." As much as I love his questions, I love their answer. I don't know. Every time I hear that, I don't know. I think of, you know, when I was a kid, you know, my mom was asked, "What were you thinking?" I knew exactly what I was thinking. I don't know. You play dumb. And the best part about that, you know, I think that was, I don't know if it was a desired reaction when Jesus asked that question, their answer, but man, it really fits in. I love the irony. Here are the people, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, which the rest of the people hold as their teachers. These are the ones they go to as for questions, right? What does the scripture say on this? What is this? What is that? The people are looking at him. Jesus asks them a question, and they say, "I don't know." And that's great. I love it. So the people, when they're looking, if they're really paying attention, they know that these Pharisees and Sadducees, they're either up to something, they're doing something tricky, underhanded, or so that they're lying, or they're just dumb, and they don't get it, because they should have known. They knew. They knew the two answers. They just were unwilling to commit. As they argued amongst themselves, they said, "Heaven or men?" I love this because, you know, Jesus, the great teacher, he says, you know, they ask him a question, and he teaches that there's two sources. It's either going to come from heaven or it's going to come from men. He takes the teachers of the age and he embarrasses them. But then he also answers the question without even trying, twice. Right? He says, was John's baptism from heaven or men? Remember, they asked, what authority did he do these things? What are the options, heaven or men? And then he asked them another question with the same answer, could be heaven or men. Well, what's the answer to the second question? Well, if you have an honest heart, you'll know it's from heaven. If you remember the history between Jesus and John, when Jesus went to be baptized by John, John confessed Jesus. So anyone who is a follower of John would then know the answer to that question. So, then a little later, just in case you didn't catch it, he answers it again just after that. He says in 21 verse 28, "For John came to you in the way of righteousness." So just in case you missed it the first time, here's the answer to the question that you asked me. And here's the answer to the question that I then asked you. Just to make sure that it's all cleared up, that there's no questions in your head, here's the answer. So again, the wisdom behind this, it's not just answering the question. Anyone can answer a question. A lot of people can get it right. It's answering a question that shows the motive of the other person. And in this case, it's great how he made them answer his question for him, and then he answered it again twice. So that takes skill, and to do that on the spot, to come up with a question immediately that causes a reaction in you that I want to see, that will convince everyone else around me of what I already know definitively, that takes real wisdom. You know, knowledge is one thing. You know, knowing something is right or knowing how to do it is one thing. But then being able to apply it, you know, so gracefully to such a masterful level, to give you exactly what you want from another person, that's just amazing. And Jesus was the master of all of this. So next, what was important to Jesus and what kind of things did he stress? I think that's a very easy question to answer, but we'll kind of go through it a little bit anyway. In Matthew 13, he talks he's going through a couple of parables, and he's talking about heaven and what it might be related to. He says in Matthew 13:44, "The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in the field, which a man found and hid again, and from joy over it he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field." So in this case, we'll read the next one also, 45. "Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking fine pearls, and upon finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all that he had and bought it." So we see in both cases, Jesus is saying, you know, the question that he's answering is he's giving you something to compare heaven to. But if you look at what he's saying, you know, he's saying heaven is like a great treasure or a great pearl, which you are willing to get rid of everything else you have to get this thing. This thing, heaven, is more important to you than anything else that you have, anything else that you could own, because we don't know what this man owns. Anything you own, anything you could own, anything you ever wanted. This treasure that you found is more important, and it trumps it all, so that you do anything you can with great joy to go secure this thing, to go get this thing. Now again, what I'm trying to show you is, you know, these are some wise men that we can learn from. This shows their wisdom. Now, what was important to them? Well, he's telling you flat out here, heaven is more important than anything else that you can get. This is where your energy and your time, everything should be spent. And then let's go to another one, I suppose. Matthew 22, 36 through 40. And we'll go ahead and turn that. So again, someone asked him, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" And he said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind." It's pretty straightforward there. The greatest commandment, what is the greatest, what is the most important thing that we should be doing? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. This is a great, so great commandment and foremost. So great meaning it's big, it's more important than other. Foremost meaning it's first, it's the first one. It is the one that you should be following. The second is like it, he goes on. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets. So we see what's important to Jesus. What's important to Jesus is, first, according to this reading, we love the Lord our God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul. It's also important that we treat each other as he would expect us to. You know, sometimes, I know we know it, but sometimes we forget, at least not just in the thought, but definitely in practice. Every one of us, Jesus hung on that cross for. Every single one of us. If you can imagine, you sent your son to die for, we'll say John, I've been picking on him a lot. And then someone else harms John. How do you feel towards that someone else? Remember, you sent your son to die for him. You're not real happy. That's not a very good thing. He sent his son to die for all of us. So he expects us to treat each other as though not only he died for me, but he died for you also. So these are the two things that are important to Jesus. Love God, love each other, and treat each other not only as we would have you treat us, which we've heard all of our lives, but as God would have you treat them, as God would treat them. And if you take it that far, you know, treat each other as God would treat. If I had to treat John as God would treat John, remember what God did for John. That's a heavy thing. And to go against that would be very, very offensive, I believe, to God. So the world's wisdom. We've been going through this and we've shown these people who have God's wisdom and what they did and what they thought was important to them. And that's well and good, unless you contrast it. You know, I like saying, this is what you should do, this is what you should not do. This is what you're doing that's wrong, this is what you should do. So this is the world's wisdom. This is what we should not do. Let no man deceive himself. If any man among you thinks that he is wise in this age, he must become foolish so that he may become wise. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness before God. For it is written, he is the one who catches the wise in their craftiness. And again, the Lord knows the reasonings of the wise, that they are useless. So think for yourself, what is the wisdom of this world and what is the wisdom of this age? Well, I remember when I was young, the wisdom of this age was you had to go up onto a mountaintop and meditate for years to find the meaning of life. Now, knowing that you know that you can flip to a book at the end of a book written by the wisest man in the world, which should be a tip-off, and there'd be, right there in black and white, the meaning of life. You think spending a year or two or three on a mountaintop meditating, eating leaves, sounds a bit foolish? Maybe a little bit. Do you think, from God's perspective, sometimes it's hard for us to understand the perspective of, you know, this is what we know. We know this earth. We know we need food. We know we need clothing. It's hard for us to comprehend heaven. But try to imagine you're in heaven. That's what you know. That's what's real to you. People are created on earth. They're created, according to Solomon, the whole of man is to fear God and keep his commandments. That's what they're there for. Again, you know heaven. You're looking down on these people. And they're busy rushing around in their lives, you know, trying to get more money, trying to get more food, trying to get their clothes, worried about, you know, whatever. All things that begin and end in this world. All the things that Solomon said were vanity of vanities. All of these people that are rushing around doing this, you know, you're looking down from heaven. They're doing it in their wisdom. Don't you look at that as foolishness? So I think that's what this verse is saying is, you know, we had the law and the prophets. And that was our schoolmaster. And it was very, very, it was based in the physical. And then we come along and we have the spiritual, which is not. And I think that's exactly, I think that's exactly this point. I know that you understand the physical and the carnal, so that's how I'm going to talk to you for now. But there will come a time when you need to grow up and you need to start thinking about the spiritual. You can see that in every aspect of our lives. You know, the law and what we're under now, the New Testament. If you look at man's history as a whole, you can see that as a whole, men grew up, or at least were expected to. You can look at your own life when you start out as a baby, and you start out and everything is very physical, and then as you get older, you become a little more wise, and now you start to think about more spiritual things. So you can see it both in yourself, you can see it in other people, you can see it in everything that progresses. First, you start out in youth and foolishness, where everything that you can understand has to have a physical, carnal relationship, a tie to something that you can understand and tie into. And then as you get older and you kind of develop a bit, now you've gotten to the point where now you can actually understand some things. You know, have kids. They're great for teaching you that. At first, you have to, you know, every single thing you have to spell out for them. And then they start thinking on them by themselves. So that's what he's saying here. God's wisdom seeks spiritual things and man's wisdom seeks earthly things. And this world is not about this world. This world is not about fleshly things. It's not about this world. This world is a race. So go ahead and turn to 1 Corinthians 9, starting in verse 23. I do all things for the sake of the gospel so that I may become a fellow partaker of it. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. But I discipline my body, and I make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. So a lot of times you hear, especially for children, it's a journey, not a destination. You know, go out there, have fun, do your best. This one, you have to win. This race, you have to win. Luckily, it's not a first place, a second place, third place. You have to finish. We'll put it that way. You have to end this race. You have to compete in a way that you will win. The stakes are too high. You know, like I said, think about it. Heaven is eternal. I've been here 33 years. I can remember back, you know, what was important to me when I was 5 or whatever. I can remember, you know, things that I've done that I would have regretted or that I regretted. I can remember things that I did or didn't do that I wish I would have. Can you imagine, you know, even before that, it's still spotty. Can you imagine, you know, even 100 years from now? What you'll be able to remember, what was important to you. We can comprehend 100. You know, it's the same thing as the law and our law of grace now. I can remember, well, I'm sure at some point I would be able to remember 100 years back. But even 33 is a problem. We go to 100, and then, okay, eternity, maybe 1,000, maybe 10,000, 100,000, you know, take it as high as you want. I start losing it after, you know, 100,000. It's like the nation's debt. You know, I can understand my debt. I can wrap my hand around it. But I can't wrap my head around trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. I have no idea what that means. You know, you tell a kid how much a house costs, they don't know. I think we have the same problem with eternity. We don't really understand what that really means, you know, because I've been here 33 years. I don't know what eternity is. So for eternity, you know, we're here maybe 80 years. Things seem so important here. Even though we're told over and over by, you know, you would think the wisest man that ever lives comes up to you and says, no, this is what's important, you would listen. But no, we have to learn the hard way. You know, the school of hard knocks is such a familiar concept to us. That's how we have to do everything for some reason. But just think about it. You know, how long of a time that is. You know, you're in a race where the stakes are that high. And not only is it the amount of time, but it's the level of consequence. You know, it's going to happen. It will last forever. It will be either really, really good or really, really bad. It seems like it makes the decision really easy, but we're very, very hard-headed, I think. So as a race, I would have trouble giving a lesson of any kind without, you know, talking about this. To win the race, of course, that means you're saved. That means you go to heaven. So how do you actually do that? How do we run this race? And I tried to come up, you know, fill in the analogy a bit. It fell apart a little bit at Confess. Maybe someone can help me with what goes in that blank. But you can imagine you can't run a race without knowing it exists. You have to find out. Either see a poster or word of mouth or something. You have to know it's there. Well, you're lucky you're here today. You know the race exists. I told you. You have to believe it. You can come here and listen to me all day long and not believe a word I say, and it doesn't do you any good. If I tell you, hey, you know, there's a 10K out down south at such and such time, and you're like, no, there isn't. He's got the date wrong. You definitely won't show up. You have to believe that it's there. You have to believe that it's going to happen. And you have to repent, which means that, you know, you believe the things that these wise men say, that, you know, our whole is to follow God. Now, if our whole is to follow God, then you will feel sorry for everything that you have done that is against that. You will start to do things that are for Him. So that's the repent. And in that, that's really a decision that I'm going to enter that race. I'm not only going to enter the race and put my name on the ballot, but I'm going to get out there and I'm going to run, and I'm not going to stop running until the race is over. Then we have confess, which may not be in the race. I don't know, maybe signing your name on the line or something. But confess, you have to confess that Jesus is the Son of God, that He is the Christ. It's through Him that we have our salvation. So you have to confess that you believe that, that it is through Him. You can imagine, you know, God sent His Son to this earth to die. It's, I don't know, it seems like a small request. Baptism. Let's go to 1 Peter 3:21. I like this verse too. It says, corresponding to that, baptism now saves you, not the removal of dirt from the flesh, but an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, don't miss that. There is some context above it I'd encourage you to read. But it says, baptism now saves you. Okay, so I don't know how anyone could, you know, say it doesn't when it says there in pretty plain English, you know. If I say baptism doesn't save you, I can say, oh, wait, no, it does. Baptism now saves you. They will say probably, well, no, baptism is a work. You can't earn salvation on your own. And I think he answers that right there. It says, not the removal of dirt from the flesh. He's saying, no, this isn't something physical that you're doing. Stop thinking of the physical. Stop thinking of the law. Stop thinking of the carnal. That's not a physical thing. It is an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. This is not earning your salvation any more than signing a contract earns you a house. You still, well, in that case, you still have to make the payment for the house. In the salvation's case, Jesus made that payment for you, but you still have to sign your name. Why underwater? You know, you can make a lot of arguments as to, well, it's similar to the burial of Christ. I don't know. I don't think it matters. That's what he said, and he has every right to, you know, state the terms. If not only is he the one that's providing heaven and hell, but he's the one that's providing the way to get there. If he said hop up and down 20 times singing I'm a Little Teapot, I think he would be within his rights. Luckily, he hasn't. After that, you can imagine you enter the race. What do you have to do then? You have to run the race. You can't enter the race and then not show up. You can't enter the race, take a few steps, and stop. You have to run the race. If you stop running the race, even though you've done all of the rest of this, you still will not win. So this is the plan for salvation. I hope I've said something that's useful. Hope at the beginning, you know, the beginning was all building up, I think, to this chart. This is what these wise men thought was important. This is what I think they would tell you to do today. And this is how you go and do it. If there's any of these things that we can help you with today, please let us know as we stand and sing.
Thank you.